You're listening to the Sprues and Brews podcast, your weekly podcast looking at all things Warhammer. Hello and welcome to episode 131 of the Sprues and Brews podcast. My name is Dave and I'm joined once again by Matt.
Hello.
And Jay.
Hello, Joe. I was trying to find out what hello in Elvish was then. I thought it might be quite thematic for this week's episode, but I couldn't. I didn't think fast enough, and I still don't know. So,
well, you've got to the Lumineth section to find it, and then you can use it at the beginning of that segment. I think that would work quite well. So, Jay's very excited on this week's show because we're going to be talking about the Lumineth, because they've just had a raft of new models, and we happen to have both of the new books. So, we've got Broken Realms Techlist, and we also have the brand new Battle Tome. So Jay and Matt will be taking us through both of those books later on in the show. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to listening to you guys chat elves later. They do sound very, very powerful, spoiler alert. So look forward to hearing about them later on. We've also got the top three returning for another week, and this week we're going to be looking at old systems we'd like to see reboxed with brand new shiny plastic miniatures. This is off the back of Necromunda getting a new starter box, I guess is the best way to call it, isn't it, Matt? So we decided to have that as our top three. We have had a massive amount of community top three entries this week, so I don't think we'll be able to squeeze them all in, but we will pick out some for later on in the show. And of course, we have also got all the latest news as well, which will be coming up in the next segment. But before we get to said next segment, let's talk about what we've been doing in the hobby this week. So, Matt, what have you been up to?
So, it's been, when I was writing this, I thought, oh, it's not been that busy a week hobby-wise, but I managed to get a few things done. So, I finished the Starblood Stalkers. They are gorgeous models. Really, really enjoy painting them.
They're great from all the world's bands.
Yeah. So looking forward to using them on the battlefield. I also completed the Slave Ogrins as well for Necromunda. Equally nice models to paint. And they've been sitting there half done for a couple of weeks because I was distracted by the Seraphon. So I thought, oh, I best get them finished before I crack on with the next project. And I started the next project. So I've done all the undershading on two Mega Gargants. So obviously flesh looks better when it's nice and smooth, so I tend to use the airbrush for it. I spray them Greysir or Wraithbone. I think I've got one in each ear, to be fair, because the colours are slightly different, but hey, it'll be fine. And then I get Dryad Bark Air and apply that with the airbrush to all the kind of shadowed areas. So kind of like, you know, under their arms and the lower areas of the faces and, you know, under the folds of their belly. So that when I get to do the flesh kind of coat with the airbrush, it'll give it a nice kind of shaded gradient when it goes into those shadowed areas. So all appreciations done on them. I might even get the skin down after the podcast. We'll see. And then I also had a game on Tabletop Simulator against Dave.
You've finally used Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah, it's still not the same as playing properly, is it? But it was bearable. And I was using the Sons of Bayomat, so I only had six models, so maybe that's why I coped with it. If I was doing a Horde army, I'd have fallen out with it, I think.
I think you enjoyed it more than... I think it was bearable. I think that was an understatement. I think you enjoyed that little game of Warhams, Matt.
I did enjoy it. It was fun to play after however long
the score?
It's been. So it was lots versus not that lots, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was a pretty accurate rendition of the score. it was my first time out using the Bone Reapers, so it was a bit of a learning experience. And plus, we've not played Warhammer for quite some time. But yeah, those 35 wound giants, and he had three of them, and then a big unit of Ale Guzzler Gargants. They were quite a challenge.
Man crushers, Dave. Man crushers. They're not their lesser brothers, the Ale Guzzlers.
Sorry, of course. But it was a really fun game, and what was really fun was using the Bone Reapers, because I think one thing that Tabletop Simulator does quite well is you can sort of play around with an army on there without having to spend all of your monies on models, and you can instantly kind of get a slight feel for how the army works and if you would enjoy using them. which I definitely did. I definitely did enjoy using the Bone Reapers. Definitely look forward to getting all mine kind of painted and on the tabletop. And on that point, actually, I think that's quite a nice segue into what I've been doing this week. So off the back of that, I've actually been not really doing much in the way of painting, but I have been building quite a lot. So I've been trying to crack on and build a lot of my Bone Reapers, because we were talking during the week, and Jay, you intend to build a lot of your Lumineth when they arrive, so we can at least get some games in, you know, as we gradually kind of paint them up. So I thought, well, I've got a lot of Bone Reapers that I need to build. So I've done the Endless Spells, I've done the Death Riders, and I've just started doing more of the Mortec Guard, because I've got another 20 of those to build. I kind of know how I want to paint them, but I've not fully committed to a scheme yet, because I'm still toying with it. So a couple of nights ago, I really wanted to do some painting, but I wasn't quite sure what was doing on my Bone Reapers yet. So quite foolishly, I decided to start painting an Ogre Tyrant, who's kind of sat next to me, I'm really trying to take my time on him, because he's a really, really nice model, and I'm really enjoying it, which I really wish I'd not done. Because he's got me thinking, like, you know, Matt's doing Death, Jay's doing Order, you know, I could do another Death Army, but wouldn't it be cool to do Destruction? Could Destruction be getting some cool new stuff with this new, like, whatever he's called, come in? You know, could that be something for the Destruction faction? Anyway, I don't know. I'm getting sidetracked. But I'm going to get him painted anyway, and then I'll probably go straight back to the Bone Reapers once I've decided on a scheme. But I thought it'd be a nice side project to paint.
So I like Ogre. Plus, you've got the Ogre in Cursed City too that you could paint up.
Yeah. I'll definitely be painting him. I've got a small amount of ogres, and you know, the Beastclaw Raiders Start Collecting Box is kind of like winking at me, but he's nice, and they're nice big models, and they're a kind of army which I think you could probably paint in a week, or a couple of weeks.
Depends how many Noblars you've got.
Yeah, a big unit of Noblars. That's me really in the hobby. This weekend, obviously, I played Matt on Tabletop Simulator, which was a lot of fun, even though I got battered. Jay, what have you been up to in the hobby this week?
So on the hobby side, I've been building and putting a bit more paint on some Infinity. So I had some new models turn up for Pan Oceana. Some really cool. They're like knights, like a bit like Black Templars, but in more high-tech armor, they look like. So that's cool. But I've not done loads. I've only built two of them. On the painting side, I've not done any really. I put a little bit more paint on my tag, but he's still not finished. And then I've just been reading through the Lumineth Battle Tome and Broken Realms Techlist.
We've had a busy week reading, haven't we, really, Jay?
Yeah, that's it. I'm sort of gearing myself up. So I've put my order in for pretty much. I've emptied Heesh of all of the Lumineth. They're all coming to my house this weekend.
Over on a big island.
Yeah, on a big slab, that's it. But it's Bank Holiday weekend, isn't it? So it depends how well behaved the post is, whether I get them before the weekend or not. So I have my fingers crossed that I've got a long weekend of building elves. Otherwise, I'm just going to have a long weekend of reading through the battle tome again. So yeah, so not much hobby progress to report this week, really. Hopefully more next week.
Excellent stuff.
I will say I jumped on the Infinity bandwagon as well. I forgot to mention it because I think I'd like scoured it from my mind. But I mentioned last week I'd built my GSA starter box. Like, yeah, this is really cool. And I'd picked up a couple of the Aragato bikes and their tag. And oh, I said the GSA starter box wasn't an enjoyable build. That tag. I built two Titans and a Forge World Dragon with no pinning, went together like a dream. This guy, it must have taken me about 3 hours to stick his hand to his wrist. I had to drill it out and pin it in the end.
Oh dear. I think that one is an older sculpt. So I've got three of the newer tag sculpts, and They're not that fiddly, I don't find half. The models themselves, the Infinity models, the infantry, they are still fiddly, but I think the JSA tag is a few years old now.
Yeah, I think they seem to have some weird, really weird connection points where I think, yeah, to be fair, I think the newer models are better designed than these ones were.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just spoilt from Games Workshop, aren't we, really?
We are.
The majority of Games Workshop models are very, very enjoyable to put together. Especially the push fit.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah. But yeah, so they're all built. So hopefully, after the Giants, I might try and get some paint because I've not actually painted any Infinity yet. And I think you were mentioning last week on the show, Jay, they're a bit of a smaller scale and suit more kind of like realistic colour schemes as well.
Yeah, they're more scaled. Like, I mean, the models are a bit bigger than Lord of the Rings models, but they're scaled the sort of same. I don't know, like, there's something about the hands, isn't there, that are bigger on Warhammer models than on these models. But
yeah. So Warhammer models are like heroic scale, heroic, these are more like true scale. So, yeah. You know, if you've done art class and you kind of number of heads that makes up your body, that's in line with what an actual person would be, basically.
Got you, right, yeah. I mean, on the Infinity side, I did have a game of Infinity this week, actually, with my brother on Tabletop Simulator. So that was interesting. That's the first game of, because we both got the M4 rule books and our models back when M4 launched, and then we went into lockdown. We didn't have a chance to use them. So this was our first M4 game. So we're halfway through it at the moment. We had to save it. As you can imagine, our first Infinity game for a very, very, very long time. We've been flicking through the rules trying to figure out what
everything does. Via Tabletop Sim as well. How did it handle the obviously, you want dense scenery in Infinity, don't you?
Yeah, there's lots of buildings and stuff. We had no problem with it, and there's a massive Tabletop Simulator Infinity scene. There's a big Discord channel for it all. I think the actual Corvus Belli, the guys who make it, they run tournaments and stuff in there, so it's well supported, and all of the assets and things are in there. They've got some like custom made tables, so you, like scripted setup they call it in Tabletop Simulator, where you just drag a bag onto a certain part of the board and it just creates the entire map and puts all the objectives and things down for you, all of your order pools, your score counts, all that sort of stuff's all taken care of. You've even got bits in Infinity what you can do, which you can't really do in Warhammer. I think there might be one or two rules, but not many, where I think it actually Warhammer Fantasy probably is what I'm thinking about, where you can hide things on the board. So I remember in Warhammer Fantasy, you could have like gutter runners inside, or is it gutter runners, or the Skaven Assassins inside a unit of clan rats, but you didn't have to
write
tell
down yet which one they're hidden in.
Exactly, yeah. So in Infinity, you get a similar concept. So some models have a rule called hidden deployment or camouflage and things. So you have to secretly make a note of where that model actually is. And then during the game, you can reveal the model. So in the game I had against my brother, I was moving a squad of Hollow Men, really cool heavy infantry, around the corner of a building, thinking I could get a run on this terminal that I had to hack. And then my brother said, I'm afraid, Jay, I have a person on the roof there in hidden deployment with a rocket launcher. So he just appeared and shot a rocket at me, which is fun.
Excellent stuff. I think that wraps up our hobby updates for this week. We've got plenty of content to get through, so we're going to come back with this week's news. Matt, I believe we have a little bit of a quieter week for news this week.
Well, it's a quieter one, but we've got a big old box on pre-order. Yeah, Cursed City is finally off for pre-order. We are super excited to play this one. It looks so good. Did you see Nick Baton's How to Play video?
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't see that.
Well, if you head over to the Warhammer YouTube channel, Nick Baton has put together a video showing you the mechanics of the game, and it's basically a refined version of Blackstone Fortress. So there is, as we suspected, a day and night mechanic. The more turns you take exploring the city, the more the hours tick by, and when night falls, well, you know, it's a city full of vampires, isn't it? So good things can't happen there. And I think that's really cool because that was one of the things in Blackstone Fortress. It was very easy, and Silver Tower before it, I guess, it was very easy to kind of like clear the entire floor and get all the items and make sure you're fully healed before you move to the next room. Where if there's an element of time pushing you on, that should make it quite interesting.
Yeah, some games, board games, do suffer with that sometimes. That like lack of agency, where you you say you can just sort of like game the game almost. So yeah, it's cool to have that thing ticking in the background, forcing you to continue moving forward.
Yeah, you also mentioned they've got some other new mechanics as well, basically representing the vampire's influence over the city and then the fear of the residents. Basically, if either of those tracks say the fear gets too low, too high, then, you know, you've basically lost the whole city. Oh no. And if the influence of the vampire gets too high, he can basically exert his influence onto the various defences of the town and shoot your airship out of the sky. Again, probably not a good result. So you've got to manage these two different resource tracks and make sure that the vampire's not getting too powerful. And equally, the people of the city are reassured that these heroic adventurers are helping them. And there's different types of missions that then will reduce those two tracks. So I think it was the example on Nick's video was one that had reduced fear, in which you basically are just monster hunting. It's a bespoke setup like we've had in Blackstone Fortress, and you try and kill bad guys to kind of build up the hopes of the villagers. Another example I had was one where each next tile is drawn randomly out of a deck, so the board will evolve as you move through it while you're getting chased by an endless spell. So it's cool that they've got a few different game types in there, because Blackstone Fortress were very much all the kind of like bespoke pre-set up kind of games, weren't they?
Yeah. Is there options then to just play a one-off, like run through like a normal dungeon crawler, or is that clear yet? Do we know?
Don't know. I mean, I imagine you could probably play a one-off game of one of those types of missions. Yeah. But I think it really comes into itself when you play as a campaign. They mention that all of the characters level up, and then as they level up, the difficulty of the enemies scales with you as well. So if, for example, using a similar initiative track at a Blackstone Fortress where you draw a card and that tells you how many enemies there are, but on that one, that was scaled by the threat level generated by the little drones, wasn't it? What scales now is the combined level of the party.
Right, okay.
So if you're all, you know, level 5 adventurers, more enemies spawn. So that's quite cool. It keeps it interesting. It means that they can probably add more stuff as expansions as well, and again scale it to different difficulty levels. So yeah, it looks quite interesting. And then obviously there's the big kind of raid missions where you're taking out one of the various bosses, I guess, from the city. So yeah, it looks really, really cool. Obviously we don't know all the details yet. We haven't had a chance to play it yet, but hopefully we'll get a chance to check it out soon. It looks really cool. It's going to be £125. I think that's kind of ish what we were expecting. I think it's £120 last week. I don't think that's a bad price personally. What about you guys?
I mean, big box games like this can be pricey, can't they? £125 is right at the top end of what I'd be willing to pay, but I think it's an okay figure.
Yeah, that seems pretty reasonable to me, to be fair, compared to some kind of games you get on Kickstarter and stuff. We're talking about £100 from a third-party site. And if you're a vampire player, obviously all the contents can be used in your growing Soulblight Gravelords army, which is what definitely is going to go into mine. So yeah, so that is the only pre-order. There's also a novel coming alongside this, and I believe you get an extra character card if you buy the novel. I think the novel is about a wizard in that city. I guess it'll just use the generic Empire wizard model, but get his character sheet.
I was tempted by this. Yeah, you can just buy the Mortal Wizard set, and I think he's a death wizard, I think. So it could be quite fun.
Yeah, I quite like that. And there was talk on the Facebook page that it'd be cool if they could bring out character cards for other Warhammer heroes. They did so with Silver Tower, so that'd be really fun, being able to kind of expand the game with kind of old miniatures that you might have.
Yeah, I like that. Well, even with Blackstone Fortress, they did proper expansions with new characters. I really hope they do that as well.
I imagine they will, because that seems like a no-brainer. Obviously, in Blackstone Fortress, there was a few hints to what was coming on some of the cards as well. So I think once we've got our hands on it, we'll have to have a proper peruse through and see if we can see any hints of the future. I think the Amble was literally on the back of the playing cards for Blackstone Fortress. So we'll see. But yeah, it looks really cool. We got a little bit of Lord of the Rings news as well. Obviously, last week we had a random kind of Easterling release, didn't we? Which kind of came out of nowhere. I'm like, okay, that's different for the kind of Easterling assassins. And today we got a post on Warhammer Community talking about Dane Ironfoot and Thorin the Third. Now, this is a period of Middle-earth history that I wasn't aware of, and I've actually done a bit of research pre-podcast just to look at this, because I wasn't sure if this is something maybe Games Workshop had invented, but no, it's actually established lore that's in the appendices of The Lord of the Rings. And while the Battle of Pelennor Fields was going on, an army of Easterlings marched on Dale and Erebor in order to put some pressure on there, because if Minas Tirith fell, then Sauron had won a stronghold in the north, and Erebor's a pretty good stronghold, isn't it? Mm. And yeah, there was the Battle of Dale, which had the Men of Dale and the Dwarves fighting back this Easterling army. So it looks like potentially we might get an expansion based around that, which seems really cool.
Yeah, especially
that would be cool. Like Men of Dale as well.
Yeah. Now, spoilers, apparently the Dwarves and the Men of Dale lost. The Easterlings didn't manage to besiege the Gate of Erebor, but then Bard the Second and Thorin the Third managed to lift the siege and save the day, driving the Easterlings out of Dale. So that'd be a cool little campaign, that, especially since I imagine that entire synopsis I've just given is the entirety of the stuff in the book. So they've probably got a little bit of leeway there to kind of expand on it and add some cool new stuff.
Mm. Yeah, it's the first Lord of the Rings sort of release I've been excited for, really, for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Easterlings. You like dwarves. We were saying when we saw this news, oh, should we do this? Because they're normally kind of campaign books as well, which is fun. So you can start with small forces building up to, I guess, the big battle being the siege of Erebor.
Yeah.
Erebor seems to have a bad time in these stories, doesn't it?
I know, yeah.
But yeah, so we don't know when that is out, but presumably soonish, since they're showing off models for it. And we also saw a new model for the Adeptus Sororitas, the Dogmata. So she's pretty cool. Her job, basically, is to condemn sisters who have maybe sinned. Mm. She's the one who forces them into the various contraptions where they can repent for their sins.
That's a lovely job she's got.
Sister Oberon, isn't it?
It's what?
Sister Oberon.
Yeah,
looks like the Necron special character.
Yeah, it's a very similar pose. And yeah, her day job, I guess, is giving sermons that inspire all her troops. So in the article, they say that she's kind of the Sisters of Battle equivalent of a chaplain stroke commissar. Yeah, it's good to have a few more kind of character options for the sisters, and that's quite a few new kits we've seen, so presumably this is going to be a sizable release as well.
Mm. Do we think this is before AdMech then, or after AdMech? Probably before, is it?
We've seen the front cover of the AdMech book, and they did say April for AdMech. And how many weeks have we got in April? It's not a massive one, is it? Is it a long month, April? 30 days.
30 days.
So obviously pre-order the 3rd is Curse City. So that's out the 10th. So that only gives us two more weekends within April. So one of them is going to be Adeptus Mechanicus. The War Master Titan is got to drop soon, and then maybe bringing us on to May for Sisters. I mean, I kind of guess that we might get Vampires in April, but there doesn't seem to be many enough weeks for it, really, does there?
No. And didn't we see a Vampire book for May you spotted last week?
Yes, there was a Vampire book for May. There's one coming out alongside Curse City, and I think there's another one in May, and I believe that the Underworld's Warband's out in May as well, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's the week following. But really, yeah, they've got a lot of stuff to cram in these few weeks, haven't they?
Yeah.
And Bellicor, whatever that's coming
up. So who knows? I mean, we've seen a massive Lumineth release last week, so we might just get jam-packed releases for the next few.
They could just do it in one week, couldn't they? Yeah.
Yeah, so, but hopefully, I've got a feeling that we'll see the next Warhammer preview soon. It's not this weekend, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's the following weekend, because then all the Lumineth stuff's out, all the Curse City stuff's out, whatever's up for pre-order next is on the way, and that's normally when they show off the next wave. So we might see more of the Sisters there, might see more of the Adeptus Mechanicus, we might see the full range of the Vampires. So yeah, I think it's going to be an exciting few weeks for the hobby.
Absolutely, I can't wait. So that wraps us up for this week's news. I think it's time to talk about some elves in the Mortal Realms. So, Lumineth fans, here we go. So between the two of you, you've been delving quite a lot into Broken Realms Techlist and the latest battle tome for the Lumineth. So I don't know who wants to take the first part, but why don't you talk about the new Lumineth books, guys?
Yeah, so obviously we've got a full kind of like analysis and in-depth look at all the kind of war scrolls and everything over on YouTube and the website. So we don't want to kind of retread old ground too much. So what we're probably going to talk about is some of our favourite units from the book, and then really kind of focus on the lore side of things from Broken Realms Techlist. So there may be spoilers ahead, but we'll try not to go too deep into spoiler territory, will we, Jay?
No, you can get to the website if you want to see all that.
So obviously we've had a load of new units added within both these books. And I think the first thing we need to mention really is that if you've got the old Lumineth battle tome, all the new stuff, literally every new page, is in the back of Broken Realms Techlist, which we were kind of, obviously we kind of divvied this up to do the review, and there was a bit of concern with, well, hang on a second, there's going to be new lore pages, new artwork, all that kind of stuff within the new battle tome. We don't want to miss out any of that. And yeah, each and every one of those pages has been duplicated and put in the Techlist book. What did you think of the way they've split that, Jay?
Yeah, I think that's really, really good. Like I say, I was unsure. I mean, Games Workshop tried to make a point in the week up to the pre-order to say, you know, you only need Broken Realms Techlist if you've already got the original Lumineth battle tome. And I was like, yeah, are all the battalions really going to be in Broken Realms Techlist? Are all the warlord traits really going to be in there? Is there going to be extra like lore that's missing from the, you know, from the version 2 battle tome for version 1? And there isn't. It's like you say, it's page for page copy of all of the content from Broken Realms Techlist. So if you're not interested in the narrative, you can just pick up. If you're not interested in picking up Battletome version 2, you can grab Broken Realms Techlist and you're okay. You've got everything.
Yeah, and equally, all the other pages are page for page exactly the same as the old Battletome as well.
Yeah.
So you're not missing out on anything by getting it. I do understand that I'll rub some people up the wrong way, where basically it is a version 2 of the same Battletome, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's probably one of my only criticisms of the version 2 of the battle tome is that they didn't change any of the original content. And the bits that I would have liked to have seen updated would have been the painting guides. Now, the painting guides are fantastic, but there are a couple of new great nations, as we'll probably talk about, in this battle tome, but no painting guides for them, which is a shame.
Seems a bit of a missed opportunity, even to add an extra page in that painting guide, maybe, because they've done it with the lore and in like artwork. It's a shame because the new Great Nations are pretty good as well.
So do you want to take us through some of the new Great Nations, Jay?
This was unexpected for me, really. I wasn't expecting two new Great Nations. So these are like your Stormhost equivalent. So we got four in the original Battle Tome, which all sort of came from the Techlist side of the Realm of Light. And then in version 2 in Broken Realms Techlist, we got two more from the Tyrian side. So there's still two to go, as per all of the background we currently know about the Lumineth Realm Lords Realm of Light. So we got two new Great Nations. The Great Nation of Alumnia and the Great Nation of Helon. So Alumnia is a very sort of martial, tyrannic faction. And all of the traits and command abilities and stuff all sort of lean into a Venari heavy build sort of army, all of your spearmen, your sentinels, the new Lord Regent, and the named character as well. And then the Great Nation of Helon is one that focuses on the wind temple and the wind aligned units, like the hurricane wind chargers, the spirits of the wind, and the wind mages, and the command traits and artifacts and whatnot. They sort of lean into, I'd say, a very missile fast-moving army. And the thing about the Great Nation of Helon as well, they have a really, really nice colour scheme. This really nice sort of sea green type cloth on the bone armour. Very, very nice. So that's the addition of the two Great Nations. On top of that, of course, the main focus of this release was the Hurricane Wind Temple. So this is the alternative to the old Alarith Mountain Spirits. It's the Wind Spirits. And to go alongside that, we get a whole bunch of new Hurricane Warlord traits, artifacts, battle traits, and some War Scroll battalions as well that sort of play on the Hurricane units that are included in the book. In addition to a new spell lore, the Lore of the Winds, I think it's called. Yeah, the Lore of the Winds. So, I mean, there's eighteen spells in this book, plus all the spells on the War Scroll cards, and Teclis knows every single one of them. So really, really cool.
Yeah, I really like the wind stuff. If I was doing a Lumineth army, and I've got to be honest, I was very tempted reading this book for the last week. all the wind chargers and the wind mage, not to mention Severith and the generic Spirit of the Wind, as well as being absolutely gorgeous models, they look so good in game as well, don't they, Jay?
They look really, really strong. So one of the weaknesses of the Lumineth book version one was the mobility and speed. You know, you've got your Venari Wardens, your Spearmen, which have to stay in a tight formation and can't run or charge, otherwise they lose that bonus. Your Alarith units are very slow, can't pile in very far, like 1 inch, I think, if they're using their buffs. So it's a very slow. You only really had the Dawn Riders for a bit of board control. The Hurricane Temple just opens up all of these options. The Hurricane Wind Charges have got a phenomenal move. You can buff the move, you can make them fly. There's combos like with the Speed of the Hish and stuff where you can make the move twice. The Wind Spirits themselves are just, they must be the fastest units in the game. I mean, well, you figured out.
I clocked the Spirit of the Wind. If you get every movement buff available to you off and he makes a 12-inch charge, then this guy can cover 90 inches a turn, which is mental.
That's a record, isn't 90. It? Gotta be. And what's great about that as well, Dave, is it's not a single 90-inch move. It's a combination of about four or five different moves over the turn. So the actual maneuverability, you can go like feign attacks, retreat and charge, pile in without going towards the closest model, then move 12 inches again after the combat. It's incredible, isn't it? The amount of movement you can get from those models.
I mean, base, he's got a movement of 24 and he moves 12 inches after he shoots. And he's a hurricane, so he can move 6 inches, pile in without having to go towards the nearest enemy.
That's it. You don't need to go towards. And he also has a cool ability. Both of them do, don't they? I think where enemies within 3 inches of them can only pile in 1 inch.
Yep. So if you're fighting, if you're 3 inches away from someone with 1 inch, they cannot hit you.
He's a bit of a glass cannon. He hits very hard. His ranged attacks are very, very good. His melee attacks are nothing to sort of turn your nose up at either. But he's quite fragile at 10 wounds with a 5+ save. So you do have to be careful with him. I think he could be focused down with some spells or ranged attacks. Although he does get a 5+ ward save, which is... So he's, you know, he's not as fragile as you initially think looking at his stat line.
But yeah, he's certainly got a need for speed.
Yeah. And then I think probably the thing that I really liked as well, adding to this book, which was something that was missing from the first version, is the new scenery piece, which I think is worth a mention. So this is the Shrine Luminor, and I always have to try and flick through the book because unlike others, it's at the beginning of the... Here we are, the Shrine Luminor. So this is a piece of scenery that you can place down after territories have been chosen, but before the armies are set up. It has to be wholly within your own territory and 6 inches away from objectives. So it's just the normal deployment rules, really, for scenery. But it's got some quite cool abilities. So you can garrison a Lumineth Realm Lord's hero inside of it, so a non-monster hero. So really, you're looking for one of your mages to go inside there. And the mage that you have garrisoned in there can reroll a casting, dispelling, or unbinding roll you can reroll a casting or dispelling or unbinding roll for any friendly Lumineth hero within 12 inches of it. However, if you've got a unit garrisoned within it, it also gives you a second ability, which allows you to use a command ability without spending a command point.
Yeah, from the second battle round, if you've got someone garrisoned in it, that reroll ability extends to 24 inches as well.
Yes.
So yeah, really good terrain piece. And it looks fantastic. We saw Raid Ranfield shared some pictures on Twitter, didn't he, of how it goes together. I think it's very modular for kind of transport and storage, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I really love that. And the thing that excited me the most of seeing that, the way it's been very cleverly designed, but yeah, you can take the sort of shrine bit off the top, like you say, for storage and transport. But what really makes that really look great is the conversion opportunities. You can build some rocks on top of that to get like some floating sort of scenery for your boards. And also, if you do read Broken Realms Teclis, there's a really cool scene in that with some floating rocks, which that put me in mind of straight away, you know, stacking a load of wardens on there or something.
You ordering a few of these then, Jay?
I've only ordered one so far, but once I've built it, it wouldn't surprise me if I had a couple more. I think it's a really, really nice, very unique looking scenery piece, really. So it definitely makes up for them not having one at the with the first book.
I mean, we mentioned obviously a lot of the new kits have got a bit of an Asian vibe, haven't they? You know, we've got a fox god essentially. The shrine itself's got a bit of a Japanese Torii gate kind of vibe going on. It's just a few. I guess that represents the different great nations. We've got lots of little influences in there, which is something we've seen in a lot of recent Age of Sigmar stuff, where Tomb Kings were very on the nose Egypt. Nowadays, they seem to have lots of other influences from different places, which gives it a nice kind of, yeah, you've got those different elements in there, but then there's a whole kind of connecting tissue between the whole army. So, yeah, I like that. I approve.
Yeah. And I think as well, they've done a really good job at sort of integrating the new units into the existing battle tome. Reading through it, sometimes you find with battle tomes that there'll be like a flavour of the month almost, and some of the older units are sort of overshadowed a little bit by the new units coming in. But I didn't find that was really the case with this. I think there's still a place in most people's armies for wardens, for the Senari Cathala, for the Sentinels, of course, for Dawn Riders even. The Alarith Stone Mages and Stone Guard are still just as effective as ever, and I think they combo quite nicely with the more like glass cannon, faster moving Hurricane Temple. So that really pleased me, because sometimes I find it's almost like you're constantly playing catch up when you pick up a new codex or a new battle tome, and your army needs changing quite a bit to make it competitive again, or you know, as efficient as possible again. Whereas I didn't really find that was the case with this. I think the older units still shine.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the potential kind of question mark on that is, and it's one we're going to have to address because people will be asking it, and I do really like this book, just want to make that clear, but is this a battle tome that's been split into two battle tomes rather than a battle tome that's been expanded with new units?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think we'll ever know the answer of it, and you know, obviously there's obviously a kind of a marketing point of view for that. I do hope that's something we don't see with future books, just because, I don't know, it'll get a little bit frustrating if every release going forward then has another book to buy within a year.
Do you know, the only real comparison we've got for this at the moment is the Sisters of Battle. So they obviously had a codex before Christmas, that they quite clearly have a codex and a new range of miniatures on the horizon, probably within the next 4 or 5 weeks. Like you say, hopefully these two armies aren't kind of setting a precedence, but I can perfectly understand people's opinions on that.
See, even with the Sisters, I'd give that a pass because they're from different editions.
Yeah, they are from different editions. Yeah.
So you would expect a new book, and I don't have as much of an issue. It's more so where we've got, I mean, like the book that's in Jay's hands, some would argue, is that the book that should have come out when the original one did? And, you know, there's pros and cons to that, and you know, I'm not going to get drawn into that whole kind of argument on it. I'd much rather see lots of releases for an army, and the Lumineth are much better for having so many kits. There's only so many that Games Workshop can put out at a time. If this is the way they have to split it, then so be it. But is it necessarily the right way to do it? Maybe not. I would rather have a new battle tome rather than some of the situations we've had in previous editions of 40k, though, where you get your battle tome or codex, and then have a small library full of supplemental books. It is a lot easier if it's all in one book, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, I guess you're right. They didn't have to release a new battle tome, did they? Really, they could have just sold us Broken Realms. So
So you know, I suppose fair play to them. They've given us the options on how we want to get this additional content, haven't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it does feel like a complete army now. I don't think, I mean, obviously, the big elf in the room is Tyrion, still not in the book.
Elf in the room.
And he and also the River Temple and the Zenith Temple. So you can still see there's a future for the Lumineth. But I mean, that's the same for the Stormcast with the new chambers that they get. It doesn't feel like the book's missing anything now. You've got all your angles covered. You've got generic combat characters, which was something we were missing before. You've got plenty of different casters. You've got even battle standard bearers in there now. Artillery, different types of cavalry. So you know, from that side, it does feel like a complete battle tome.
Yeah, but while there's some strong units, I still don't think that it gives you more options, so it's not just the same cookie cutter list as well. I think we'll see a bit of variety in here as people trend towards those different kind of extremes of army.
Do you think, just slightly going off topic from Luminef just for a second, because obviously when Age of Sigmar launched, a lot of like the new armies that we saw, for example, like the Fire Slayers and stuff, they didn't have a broad range of miniatures. Do you think what's happening with the Luminef in this second wave, do both of you think that we could potentially see some of the other Age of Sigmar armies get, you know, quite big expansions and a lot more options and builds and it's kind of like temples, but like a deeper dive into different parts of the armies?
See, I'd go an extra step of that, and we're going to talk about the lore in a little bit, but we've already seen from Marathi and the events in this book that I think when this chain of events plays out, the Mortal Realms are going to be a very different place, and I don't think all the factions are going to be the same. We've seen bits of that in Marathi where she's essentially taken control of cities of Sigmar and now has a large Dark Elf, for want of a better word, contingent. The Idoneth are aligned with her as well. You know, could we see, say, come a new edition of the game, what was the Daughters of Cain is now a new faction with all those disparate Dark Elf units brought back again as a classic Dark Elf vibe. And that's kind of what we're seeing with the vampires, where they've splintered things off into little factions in AOS. They're kind of bringing them back again because I guess you've got more variety in a battle tome if you've got lots of different units. Me and Jay were chatting the other night about, you know, what if we saw something for the dwarves? And there has been mentions of dwarves in recent books and, you know, gods coming back and the like. Could unite some of the dwarven factions and see maybe Fire Slayers as a sub-element of a bigger dwarven range? I think that'd be really cool.
Okay.
Because I think there'd be room in the background for those Fire Slayers who don't want to follow the new god or follow the new way. So you can still build your dedicated Fire Slayers who sort of like, you know, turn their nose up at this new dwarven alliance or whatever. But then, you know, a battle tone should support players who are pure Fire Slayer players. But yeah, it does give you more options, doesn't it, for all of the City of Sigmar dwarves, the Fire Slayers, potentially Caradrons, potentially new stuff.
Because if you think about it, the Fire Slayers haven't got that many kits. You could make the argument that just the Hurricane stuff out of this book is kind of the equivalent range that the Fire Slayers had at first. I know they've expanded them a little bit.
Well, they've got one monster kit, haven't they? One elite
two infantry
kits. Yeah, so you know they do need the Luminef treatment, really. Mm. And there's only so many different dwarves you can make, like naked dwarves with two axes. I don't know how much more variety you can get.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just a theory, isn't it? But I'd quite like that. I think that it'd breathe some new life into some of these older factions, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like the Sylvaneth, the Fire Slayers. I mean, Stormcast have been treated quite well because they're like the sort of the main faction, aren't they, really? The main, like the Space Marine faction of Age of Sigmar.
I mean, I think we Stormcast have kind of... The spotlight's really been on the Luminef for the order at the moment. I think Stormcast are going to have, maybe when the new edition launches, I think they'll get a big new focus again. But we'll see. Maybe it'll be more so on the Luminef to be the standout order army of West.
Was it the Sacrosanct Chamber was the last big Stormcast expansion?
Yeah, the start of Soul Wars.
The start of Soul Wars and the start of the NecroQuake, which segues quite nicely, I think, Jay, into the lore of this book. So do you want to give us a bit of a summary of that? We'll try and steer away from spoilers because I know some people probably want to read this for themselves. Obviously, we've got some pretty big spoilers over on the website as well if people do want the details.
Yeah. So I'll have to be careful then. I don't want to spoil it for people. So the book basically covers Teclis's decision to sort of take the fight to Nagash. So for a long time now, since Age of Sigmar 2 launched, Nagash has sort of been the main villain, and obviously he's been, was it at the end of Age of Sigmar first edition or was it the beginning of Age of Sigmar second edition when that Katakross was reawakened, you know?
So Katakross was reawakened midway through the Soul Wars,
right? Okay, so I mean that was a big storyline as well, where the Storm Vault, wasn't it, was broken. Yeah. So for a long time now, Nagash has seemed unassailable, really, from Shaiish. He's the big ritual, the Necroquake, which basically disrupted all of the sort of harmonious afterlife for the inhabitants of the mortal realms. It sort of disrupted all that And now souls were sucked to the great Nadir, sucked to the center of Shaish's black hole where Nagash was collecting all the souls that I think he sort of said they're owed to him, aren't they? They're his souls. So
yeah.
He was a bit annoyed. He's
a strange one, isn't he? Because he's the god of death, but he only became the god of death by taking out every other death god that every religion in the mortal realms believed in. So yeah, he's a bit of a hypocrite, but hey.
So Teclis. And there's some really good bits in this book where you get a sort of history of Teclis, because obviously Teclis was a character that survived from the old world. And he was a big important character from the old world. Obviously, one half of the Tyrion and Teclis twins. He was like the frail mage who used to drink the potions to keep him alive. He had the moon staff of Lilith gifted to him, I think, to help sort of like keep his strength up and things like that. But whereas most elves are quite arrogant and quite, they look down the noses at the other races, you know, they have like an arrogance and a superiority about them. Teclis always had a soft spot for mostly humans, actually, in the old world. Yeah, so Teclis actually taught the humans the eight schools of magic. He trained up the mages. And one of the main drivers for that was that he realized that he couldn't fight back the forces of chaos. The elves couldn't do it on their own. They needed humanity to be strong enough to fight alongside them. And that sort of mentality has sort of carried on through to the Age of Sigmar. And he alone amongst the Elvish pantheon, really, understands the importance of strengthening his human allies. And he looks around the mortal realms. He can see humanity living in fear of Nagash, oppressed underneath the unrelenting march of the Ossiarch Bone Reapers. And he decides, you know, things have got to change. He's got to go out there and show the rest of the forces of order that Nagash isn't unassailable and that he can be humbled. So the book starts off really with an attack on a human settlement inside the realm of Hish. And it's the aftermath of that where Teclis really feels, yeah, right, this is it now. This is the start that's going to do it. So the first part of the book really focuses on Teclis sort of setting out on this almost like a crusade, like a propaganda shock and awe campaign to directly at the heart of Nagash's empire, the Ossiarch Bone Realms, Bone Reapers Empire, to make a statement of intent, send a message to the forces of order in the mortal realms.
I really enjoyed that part because it's like he knows that you can't make a full-on frontal attack to them, but start pulling down statues and making a bit of a nuisance and you'll get the point across. They like etch elven runes in the ground and yeah, basically causing a load of trouble in Shaish, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And of course this Nagash doesn't like this, and there is consequences for this action. And one of the cool things in this book is Alariel. So Alariel she doesn't feature a lot in the book. There's two or three scenes with Alariel, but they're really, really great scenes. And I actually think they tell more about the future of Age of Sigmar than the rest of the book, to be fair. So Alariel sort of cautions Teclis about this approach. You know, you're going to don't goad the dragon is a line she uses. And I think Alariel, obviously, she's like the complete opposite of Nagash. Nagash, the Lord of Death, Alariel, the Goddess of Life. So they're like two sides of the same coin. So I think she has a greater understanding of the balance that's needed between life and death, which I think Teclis, I got the impression, doesn't have that. For all of his sort of knowledge and, capability, I think Teclis overlooks that a little bit.
You can kind of picture Alariel kind of rolling her eyes at Teclis at times because he says in one breath that Nagash is full of pride without realizing that he's really exactly the same.
Exactly, yeah. So following this, then Nagash then obviously does retaliate. So in Act 2, we basically learn about how Nagash intends to take the fight back to Teclis. And he strikes out a couple of realms, but his focus is on the realm of light, of course, because he wants to crush Teclis, basically, for this insubordination. It's affront to his reign and his plans. The Act 2 covers the exploits of three of Nagash's Mortarks. And there's a really cool scene actually where Nagash is in his throne room and there's five mirrors behind him, and three of the mirrors contain the reflections of three of his Mortarks, Manfred von Karstein, Neferata, and who was the last, Arkhan the Black, of course. And there were two reflections that were empty, that were dark. And
well, I was thinking about this, Jay. He has got two more Mortarks. He's got okay. the Ollisander, the Lady Ollisander, even, sorry, of the Nighthaunt, and Catacross, of course, is a Mortark as well, isn't he?
Right, okay. That's interesting. I mean, that's interesting as well, because we know that there's some new Nighthaunt models coming too, so maybe Ollisander, whatever her name is, takes a more central stage going forward then.
I think she was defeated during the Stormvault book. Yeah. But, you know, undead, that's the thing with undead. Death isn't the handicap it used to be. You're always back. And Catacross is currently getting his MOT done or something after fighting Archaon.
So I won't go into too much detail about what these Mortars get up to. Manfred heads into Garan, and there's a confrontation there with Nurkle and the Sylvaneth forces in Garan. Neferata goes to Shaman, the realm of metal, I believe. And there's some cool skirmishes and battles there between the Neferata Soulblight vampires, Caradhran and Lumineth allies. And then Arkhan himself leads the attack into Heesh at the head of some Myriad Null Legion, is it? The Asiatic Bone Reapers. To basically destroy Heesh. And what their plan is to corrupt the Shaiish realm gates in those realms and turn them into like the Nadir, if she pull all the souls in and sort of corrupt the sort of realm of death in those realms, well, the afterlife in those realms. So obviously there's some mixed results for the Mortarks. And in Act 3, Nagash comes into play, and he basically heads over to Heesh to finish the job that Arkhan starts.
If you want a job well done, you do it yourself.
Yeah, that's it.
Maybe.
It was really, really cool to read about the confrontation between two gods, you know, Nagash and Teclis, both very, very powerful mages. And the duel, there's lots of to-ing and fro-ing between the duels, between the two sides there. I really enjoyed reading about it, and that the ending was fantastic. I thought it was very, very good. And then to round out the story in Broken Realms Teclis, Elariel comes back. And obviously, after the consequences of Teclis's campaign against Nagash and Nagash coming into Heesh, the fallout of that, Elariel has more words of warning. And I don't know about you guys, I'm really excited to see what's in store for Elariel and the Sylvaneth going forward.
Yeah, Teclis is a bit full of himself, and I don't think he really grasps the full consequences, does he? And Alariel's kind of hinting at the impact of what happened, and it's hard to discuss this without giving away too many spoilers. But
if you head over to the site, you can read up all our thoughts on it. But it is interesting. Yeah.
I think what happens here is definitely going to have repercussions further down the line. We know there's two more books. We know Bellicor's next. Now, in the conclusion of the book, they talk about the greater darkness. Now, presumably that's chaos, because that's always been the traditional enemy of the elves, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, Bellicor is, I mean, yeah, he's kind of like a failed version of Archaon. He was once the blessed of all four gods, but kind of had a falling out with them. So I don't know whether there's going to be an interesting, you know, something going on there, whether he's fighting chaos, or maybe he wants to be redeemed in the eyes of the chaos gods and get things done properly. Who knows? I'm interested to see how that plays out. The fact that he's got a dead chaos warrior on his base, though, probably implies that he's still not entirely happy about the chaos gods and he's going his own little vengeance. And you know, but it was Bellicor the winged figure that we saw saving the Stormcast in Broken Realms Morathi? In which case, why is he helping the Stormcast? So, yeah, there's lots of question marks, and I think we'll see a few more kind of revelations in that one. And then Book 4, all bets are off. We don't even know what it is, do we? What, Kragnos is all we know. That's literally all we know, the name of the book. I'm excited to see. I've really enjoyed the Broken Realms series. I know you've not read the first one yet, have you, Jay? But
I only know from talking to you what's happened in the first one. I've got a good idea of what's happened, what's going on in the first one. But yeah, I think where these books seem to be a step above what we see in the Warhammer 40,000 universe, simply for the fact that they really push the storyline forward. There's things that happen in this book that you would never see the equivalent really in a Warhammer 40,000 book. You know, we have the Primarch return, really. That's like the biggest game changer really in the 40K setting. You know, the return of Gulliman, I'd argue. Maybe the Rift, the Malath, whatever you call Malath. You know, the Great Rift. The
Secretrix Maledictum.
That's it, yeah. But I mean, there's that times 10 in these Broken Realms books.
The Broken Realms books are what the Psychic Awakening books should have been.
Yeah. Yeah. Arguably, we've seen some of that in the Warzone book. Not to the extent of the Broken Realms books, but I think they're trying with the 40K ones.
Yeah. I think, Age of Sigmar's a newer universe, and I think they've got a bit more, the fans are a bit more, give them a bit more freedom to develop that setting. Mm. Whereas Warhammer 40,000's got such a following and it's such a established setting that you have to be careful you don't change it too much, because then it becomes something that a lot of fans have grown up with. It's not the same thing. Yeah. So I can understand the tightrope they have to walk in Warhammer 40,000.
In AOS, the lore is very fluid, and certainly from the start of the Necroquake, I suppose, is a good point, because that ties into all this. But yeah. the over the course of this edition of the game, we've seen the storyline evolve, which is really, really cool. And if that has repercussions on factions and stuff, like you say, I think the fans would be more receptive to that, because they're not gonna make your armies useless, but it might be that, oh, I can now take some Dark Elves in my Daughters of Cain army, or, you know, I can use a combined Chaos God army commanded by Bellicor, stuff like that. Subtle changes that flow through the lore. Now, obviously, this is all guesswork at the future, but that seems to be my kind of reading of these books.
I think so, yeah. And I do get the impression that they do give a lot of thought to what the future of the game is going to look like. So I got lots of sort of impressions from this book, certainly setting up some of the Soulblight Gravelords background.
Definitely.
And also, I mean, the Alariel as well. And we know, you know, the Kanofi are a thing now. We've seen the Underworlds. We've got the Kanofi Exile in Cursed City. And, you know, reading through Broken Realms Techlist, you can sort of start thinking, well, maybe the Kanofi and Alariel, maybe that's a development that's going to happen sooner rather than later.
You know what I really liked? The city, Settlers Gain, and the fact that they kind of like, they're learning from the elves. And it just seems sort of so different than, I don't know, a hovel in the middle of nowhere with humans farming.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah. It's basically, yeah, a city in the realm of light. This is the one that comes under attack at the beginning of the book. There are rules for the city in Broken Realms Techlist, so you can actually make an army of settlers again. They've got their own battle traits and warlord traits and whatnot. But it breathes more life into the universe, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It very much got a kind of Dalaran from Warcraft vibe for the settlers again, and I kind of want to do an army. I always want to do an army, but I was really impressed with the lore, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this series plays out.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. You know, I think we've been spoiled recently from some of the Black Library books in the Siege of Terror series, and I think it's probably fair to say, and it's purely subjective, that the battle scenes are not at the level you'd get from a Black Library novel. But they're still very enjoyable. The actual lore development and the underlying story is just as riveting as what you would read in a Black Library novel.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't sure what to expect from this one, to be honest. We knew that the premise is essentially the title match between Teclis and Nagash. But outside that, I didn't foresee some of the other, let's say, game-changing moments that happen.
No, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. They don't hold back on mixing things up. So, yeah, I think you'll enjoy it.
And on that note, I think we'll let Matt and Jay catch their breath. I will put the notes in the podcast notes, a link to the website, so that you can read through the entire read-through that Matt and Jay have done. It does include spoilers. There's also a video available as well, which is in the same article. So you can check that out. And it is up for pre-order at the moment for release this coming Saturday. That brings us to the end of our look at the Luminef content. We still have the top three to go through, so we're going to take a pause and come back with that. So off the back of the recent announcement that we've got a new Necromunda almost starter box on the horizon, we decided to open the floor this week for this week's top three to revisit some of the older systems that we feel should get plastic kits at some point in the near or possible far future. So it's been definitely an interesting one for the community. We've had lots and lots of community picks, so we're going to try and read out as many as we can towards the end of the show. But before we get to that, we're going to run through our top three choices. So, Matt, would you like to start us off with your third choice?
Well, I've started us off, and this was such a hard one because there's so many classic Games Workshop games that I absolutely love. But, you know, I've had to be hard and gone with the three that I think my heart told me to go for. And at number three, I'm going for Epic 40K. Now, I don't think either of you guys ever played Epic, did you?
No.
No.
That Epic was one of my absolute favourite games from GW.
Was Epic epic?
Epic was epic. It was a bigger scale, and it used the way activations worked. You're not necessarily the general leading the army. You're the guy in orbit commanding hold like platoons and stuff. So you would give orders to units, and they could get misinterpreted by the time it gets down to the planet and they don't actually do what you wanted them to do. And they had little order dice that you put down, and basically like a leadership test to see if those orders went off properly. And there was different responses and reactions. And I think Jay would quite like Epic, because it's a bit different than we were talking to Dave from Mini Wargaming about the whole I go, you go back and forth that we've seen a lot of Games Workshop games. And Epic was very different with that. You had kind of like an attrition mechanic where kind of fire on a unit would put down blast markers, and that would represent how shell-shocked a unit was, and they might just flee from that rather than, you know, casualties, for example. Worked a bit like a lot of kind of historical games do. And obviously you had the appeal of super heavy tanks and titans and stuff that, you know, we kind of get that stuff in a normal game of 40K now, but I just quite like... that zoomed out angle. It's more like playing an RTS or something where you've got, you know, thousands of troops on the battlefield. And I just feel it's the right time for it. We've got the Titan models for Titanicus. We've got the aircraft for Aeronautica at the same scale. If they could do infantry and tanks at that same scale, I think that'd be a really popular game. You know, we've said in the past, I think we had a similar top three back before Christmas, and I said the ideal setting for it to start with from obviously it's a specialist games who fall under Forge World, set it during the Heresy and have Space Marine sprues that you can then have multi-purpose in for the Loyalists and Traitors. Obviously, you know, we had the Gargants and stuff and the Eldar Titans. And that would also then feed back into Titanicus, giving you another source of engines for that. I just think, yeah, it'd be such a good game. It'd be so popular. And just think, you could have a massive army with thousands of people in a little box. Dead easy to transport.
I think what would give me nightmares is painting them.
Well, it's not too, because if you think about it, you're looking at the regiment rather than the individual models.
Mm.
So it's they're only little, you'll still be fine.
That's what washes are for. Excellent. Jay, what is your third choice?
So my third choice, it could be my number one choice, but it's not going to be my number one choice coming in. It's Battlefleet Gothic.
Yes.
I am shocked. I have this down as your first choice.
Well, I mean, it is always, I'd love. If Games Workshop only made one more box game for the rest of their days and it was Battlefleet Gothic, I'd be happy. I had a massive Battlefleet Gothic collection of it was all metal. I think they did have plastic like cruiser sets and things in the starter set, but the Eldar faction was all metal, and that was the one I played, the Craft World Eldar. Each sort of fleet faction was completely different. Well, Chaos and Imperial were sort of quite similar, but with different strengths and weaknesses. Chaos had all their lances and quite long range. Imperials were very heavily armoured with their gun batteries. But the Eldar, the Necrons, the Tau, the Tyranids, they all played, the Orcs even, played completely differently. Very, very characterful game. I'm not saying the balance was perfect. I don't think it was. I think there were some good matchups, some bad matchups, but it was a very enjoyable game. Definitely, definitely needs refreshing for the 2021, I think. Yeah, it would be nice though.
It was a genius idea of taking naval combat and putting it in space, basically, wasn't it? With broadsides and slow-moving torpedoes,
Yeah, you could use them to break up enemy formations. You had your different orders that you could give to your ship. You could execute your commanders on the bridge and things like that. Boarding parties. Really, really cool.
Were you part of the hobby when the test rules were in White Dwarf? I think they had two issues of White Dwarf with that, the basic outline of the test rules, and Andy Chambers encouraged people to write in with any suggestions. So little Matt back in the past wrote to Andy Chambers, and I got back a letter and a Battlefleet Gothic badge, which is still on my pin board now. Yeah, nice. I don't know where the letter from Andy Chambers is. That'll be here somewhere. But I was like, oh, wow, the designer of the game has written back to me and I've got a pin badge. And then, promptly pre-ordered the big bundle where you got metal ordnance instead of the cardboard tokens in the box. And I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. So, all my pennies that year went on Battlefleet Gothic.
Yeah,
imagine what they could do with the models now, though.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, that was it. I was just going to say, they supported it quite well. Whilst I was at uni, they were still supporting it. And you're right, there was lots of extras like space stations, Ramacles star forts, the ordnance,
Blackstone fortresses.
There was the Battlefleet Gothic rulebook, and then the Battlefleet Gothic Armada. Even Forge World released kits like the Grey Knight cruisers and the Tau Tau fleets.
The Necron fleet, I think, was for Forge World.
It could have been. Yeah, I think the Necron was for metal, like the Nids. I know the Tau were metal from Games Workshop, but then Forge World did the resin sort of. So the original Tau fleet was the merchant fleet, but then Forge World did the sort of military fleet.
Yeah, the Forge World ones look more like the Tau that you would
like the Mantis
expect in 40k, whereas I remember the original Tau fleet was like you described, like more of a merchant, a very different look.
Was it the Demiurge, the race for that, I guess, kind of replaced the squats?
They were in it as well, yeah.
Recruit War Spheres as well. Yeah, there's loads of stuff, wasn't there?
There was, yeah. Adeptus Mechanicus ships.
Yeah.
It was a good game.
Excellent. My third choice is a game I never actually got to play, and that was Mordheim. So I really like the idea of it kind of creating a band of heroes, and I guess this is like one of the big appeals of Cursed City, isn't it? But Mordheim is kind of taking it that extra kind of RPG element. I was kind of torn between this and one that you could say features orcs from 40k, which I'm sure appears a lot in the community top three, and potentially will appear in this top three. I would really like to see Mordheim get redone for Age of Sigmar. I did also notice that Superfan Ray from the design studio, I think this was quite high on his top three. I would love to see like what he could do with scenery for that.
Oh yeah.
It'd be amazing. Yeah. Like so good.
I'd like to see like multi-level scenery.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why, but do you know what really comes to mind? The lake townhouses from Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
Where you've got like the walkways and stuff.
And I guess the spiritual success of the Rohan strongholds, kind of as a basis of a multi-part building kit for Warhammer.
Yeah, and it'd be great to see some like Azir architecture, or maybe it'll be set in a different realm, so you have different kinds of buildings.
So I think if they redid it, they'd have to set it in Mordheim. It's got to be that grim, gritty, filthy, sticky floored vibe of the old world, hasn't it?
That is true. Yeah, yeah. But either way, I'd like to see it come back. I'd like to build a gang from Mordheim. I think that'd be really, really cool. Excellent. Round to our second choices. Matt, what is your second choice?
Well, I've gone with you, Dave, and Mordheim, the City of the Damned. So this was kind of like a sequel, a prequel to Warhammer. This was set a long time ago, before Mordheim was destroyed by a fragment of Morslieb, the Warpstone Moon, that was orbiting the old world. And it was such a good game. It basically took everything that made Necromunda really fun. So you kind of like you say, your role-playing elements, the fact that you build your own little warband that in between games could get injured or level up, and your little guys that have just been recruited over the course of a campaign become heroes in their own rights. But then take that and put it in cramped cobblestone streets with the rain lashing down, the strange shapes in the corner of your eyes. Is it a Skaven? Nah, they're just a myth. You know, jumping from rooftop to rooftop, maybe going inside a bar and huddling down under the tables, hiding from somebody who's stalking you. They expanded it with like the woods on the outskirts of Mordheim and the beastmen that lived within. It was just such a good game, and I think the key part to it, the city of Mordheim as a character, and I feel you mentioned Cursed City. I feel games which were trying to do the same thing with what's it called, Ulfenkarm, the city out of Cursed City, kind of building it into this really kind of like grim, horrible place that you don't want to live in, but actually it's a really cool location for stories.
I used to like the White Dwarf articles for Mordheim with like the Town Crier and Swords for Hire, were they called?
I mean, if you boil it down to its component parts, it's essentially Necromunda ported to the old world, but it's, I guess, where the difference is, where you've got, you know, really tall kind of multi-level scenery and dense kind of tunnels and stuff. You change that a little bit and make it winding streets and rooftops that you can jump around. It just essentially takes the same game but gives it a completely different flavour, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would love to play that.
And you know what?
I play it originally.
I would be very surprised if it doesn't come back in some form at some point.
I'd also be very happy if Ray could make Dave's Bar as one of the locations.
Dave's
for,
Bar.
For Mordheim, that'd be really, really cool.
Well, I mean, look how successful Necromunda's been. I don't think it's... I think it's a given we'll get something like Mordheim again in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent stuff. Jay, what is your second choice?
So, my second choice is... It's a game that existed back... Oh, man. I don't know when they stopped making rules for this system. And I think with the... advances in sort of the sculpting and the how they can produce the sprues nowadays, I think we could get some incredible models for this game, and it's Inquisitor.
Yes.
54 mil, I think it was. So, two or three times taller than a regular sort of 28 mil miniature. It was sort of Necromunda, but sort of bigger scale and a bit more RPG-ish, you know. You sort of built an Inquisitor and his followers, so maybe three or four models, and played through almost like a Dungeons and Dragons style sort of RPG campaign with them.
Yeah, you would need a Dungeon Master. It was very much a shrunken down version of Necromunda mixed with a role-playing game, I guess, is the best description for it, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you can get hold of any of the old White Dwarfs, there were some amazing sort of battle reports in the old White Dwarfs. And, I mean, back then the hobby was a bit different. I mean, we still get lots of cool conversions nowadays and lots of cool sort of hobby sort of projects where people have gone to town and their armies and things like that. But when it comes to actually gaming, it's generally what you see is what you get, and all the bits you need to make a unit come on the sprue, and you build your units like that when you're playing. But back then, I think people had a bit more flexibility to be a bit more creative with their models and convert. And certainly that was the case with Inquisitors, which sort of encouraged it. You'd get all sorts of different Inquisitors converted out of all sorts of different bits with their warband followers. It was a really, really, as a hobbyist, it was a very, very cool game to play.
Yeah, I think at this point we need to give a shout out to, I think it's either the lead art designer for Games Workshop, John Blanche.
Yeah.
Who pretty much... just his twisted vision of Inquisitor stuff is just epic, isn't it? Some of the models that he did for it.
Yeah. And I think, arguably it would work well as a 28 mil scale game as well, I think.
I was going to say, Jay, one of the theories as to why it wasn't very popular, and one of the theories is that because there were 54 mil models that you couldn't use in your games of 40K, where if maybe it had been the same scale, people might have picked up the models just to use in their armies for conversions.
Yeah.
And I do think a 28 mil version, obviously you could use like all the Zone Mortalis scenery. You could put those into your army. As much as I like the scale of the 54 mil one, because they're pretty much on par with the Primarch figures that we get from Forge World. You know, they're impressive figures. But a 28 mil model... or 32, whatever they are these days, just gels better with the rest of the range, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, some of the models, we got the Eisenhorn model now, Is it Artanis or Artemis or for the
Death
Watch?
Artemis, yeah.
Yeah, the
Damian, the redemption of Flagman. We've even got Cyberhounds and Mastiffs and all sorts, haven't we?
So we're not too far from it, really, I suppose.
No, we've probably got most of the model range. I think there's a Demonette as well. Most of the model range in 28mm now, so yeah. And a lot of people do play Inquisition at 28mm scale. You just have to, you know, obviously round down some of the measurements in the same ratio, but if you can get hold of the rule book, you can easily play it with normal figures.
Worth checking out then if you've got a decent gaming group that are willing to give it a try.
You know, on my bookshelf of old books, I do have a couple of Inquisitors still.
I remember we had a game a very, very long time ago, Jay, and I remember doing a somersault over a barrier just because I could.
then we were like, Dave, come inside, you want to play Inquisitor?
I take my games of role-playing seriously, quite clearly. excellent. My second choice, actually, quickly, is one that's already been mentioned on this top three, and that's Battlefleet Gothic. So I'm a big fan of big spaceship battles. I didn't actually get to play much Battlefleet Gothic with you guys. I think you played it a lot with your brother, Jay. Yeah. I think I may have only got involved on a couple of occasions, but it really appealed. And also playing games like Homeworld and stuff on PC, that was always pretty cool. So yeah, it's definitely a box set I would like to come back. And in a similar vein to what you said, Matt, in regards to Epic basing it in the Horus Heresy, you could do kind of the same with Battlefleet Gothic, although I think it does work better when you've got a variety of different alien ships and stuff and you've got a lot more variety. But I suppose the same could be said of any box game.
Well, the original box was just Imperium versus Chaos.
Yeah. And we did hear rumours of a solar
Battlefleet Solar, there was rumours of a long time ago, but you know, things change rapidly. I'm sure it's probably still on their big whiteboard of awesome ideas, because it'd sell like hotcakes, wouldn't it?
It would, definitely. We are round to our top choices. So Matt, enlighten us with your top choice.
Well, I'm cheating a little bit, because this isn't really an old system. It's one that is still going strong to this day. And we've kind of, again, already mentioned it in passing, and that is the Horus Heresy. So me and Jay, kind of end of the last year, start of this year, on a bit of a kick to paint up some Heresy era models. After umming and ahhing about whether we'd get on with the scale compared to Primaris Marines, and actually found, these are still really nice models to paint up.
Yep.
I think one of the things that maybe lets down the Heresy is that, obviously it's a modified version of a previous edition of the game. And it is a bit of a disconnect going from current Warhammer to old Warhammer. And again, like we've said on our little stint on Tabletop Simulator, but dialed up to 11, kind of relearning the game and getting things confused.
Well, you've got like tables and weapon skill tables again.
Different universal special rules. And yeah, it's a lot to relearn. And I do wonder, would Horus Heresy, with a new plastic box set with maybe plastic Assault Marines in there, plastic Devastators, plastic Rhinos, Mark One, of course, because, you know, we're talking old school, and set it in a more, I don't know, if not the current edition of Warhammer, a slightly modified one, so it's still got those same elements, because I think the current edition of the game's really good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And yeah, I do wonder if the game would be more popular if it was, you know, more in line with that. And then that makes it easier for them porting the cool 30k vehicles to 40k as well, because you've already got there's a big difference between the stat block for, say, a 30k vehicle and a 40k vehicle, where if they're based on a similar system, it's probably easier to move them between the two games.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if this is why we never saw the kind of Adeptus Mechanicus release for 40k from Forge World, because that was based on a lot of the 30k models. Could we see plastic 30k Mechanicum? Could we see an expansion of the Sisters of Silence? You know, there's lots of cool stuff that are currently resin kits.
Imperial Army,
yeah, that'd be they work brilliantly as a plastic kit. So yeah, that's what I really hope to see. I've heard a lot of rumours that the big, I think we mentioned last week, every kind of November tends to be a big release from specialist games, be it Necromunda, Blood Bowl, Adeptus Titanicus. And rumours are this year it's a big Heresy box. So obviously we don't know anything more than that. It's just rumours. It might be wrong, but I would definitely be up for that. The hardest bit, of course, will be picking which Legion to paint that shiny new box as.
Ultramarines.
Ultramarines. You know what I've enjoyed painting Ultramarines.
Yeah. Jay, what is your top choice?
My top choice is, okay, I don't know when this game came out, but I would love it to be re-released. Even if they just re-released it as exactly as it was back then, I'd still pick it up, I think, now. And it is the Battle of Five Armies box set.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, it was a hobby game, but it didn't use the same rules as the strategy game for Middle-earth that we currently have. It was more epic scale, I think.
I think it was based on Warmaster.
Warmaster, that was the fantasy version, that's right. It came with so many models. So you got Smaug the Dragon, there was a big giant in there, the Goblin Army, the Elven Army with spearmen and archers and cavalry. There was dwarfs in there, the eagles, of course, and then there were all these creatures like the bats and spiders. Bjorn was there. The shapeshifter.
In his bear aspect, wasn't he, in the game?
Exactly, yeah. You got dice and the rules and the campaign. And then there was even like a plastic scenery, like a hill thing that you could put together as well.
It
was
modular, like modular hills that could go in different designs.
Yeah. So it was basically an all-in-one game. And it was Games Workshop, but it was different than the main Lord of the Rings line. I'm not sure how long it was available for.
So it was available until just before the Hobbit game came out, because I think it was something to do with the licensing. Obviously, right. the mainline game, they had the license to do the movies, which is why all the main Middle-earth games are based on the movies. There were some grey areas around the sides where they could work on, and I think eventually they got the rights to be able to use some of the book stuff. But for The Hobbit, originally they only had the book rights. When the film came out, their rights reverted to that, and so they couldn't produce that game anymore because it was based on the books. There's a lot of weird legal loopholes for the whole Tolkien estate stuff, and that's a whole other story. But yeah, basically, because they were doing the Hobbit game based on the films, they couldn't produce a Hobbit game based on the books anymore.
All right. So I don't know. I don't know whether I'd like a box with all the, 28 mil scale armies inside it, or just a reimagined version of, like, a Warmaster version of the existing Lord of the Rings set. That'd be cool. That'd be a nice Christmas present.
That would be cool. And I'm up for it. You know, it's epic scale, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to finish off this week's top three quite briefly and agree with Matt. I would like to see a new Horus Heresy box. I've wanted to get into this as much as you two guys have really been fired up, especially at the sort of end of last year and beginning of this year. And I think what would really help me would be a new plastic starter box with maybe some revised rules to bring it more up to how we play 40K right now. I mean, I do get, like, you want the system to be slightly different, because otherwise, you just kind of got the same system but with different models. But I think a starter box to get you into the Horus Heresy is much needed, especially with the flexibility of, like you say, Matt, painting them as you want them, as a Legion you want. Maybe have some upgrade kits you could get separately in plastic or resin, so you could take your starter box and maybe gear them more towards the Legion of your choice. But yeah, I would definitely love to see a new starter box for the Heresy.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest barrier to entry, isn't it? That it is quite expensive to get a Horus Heresy army off the ground. Yes, you can use some of the existing Space Marine kits, but really you want those old designs of armor and old style vehicles. So a new box that has some more plastic kits, so we've got quite a big plastic range, and a cheap entry point to get a starter army going, I think is what is kind of severely needed. Similar to Lord of the Rings, when they brought that back, that was kind of missing a big high value plastic box to give you a bulk of a force.
Yeah,
and then along came the Battle of Pelennor Fields, which is kind of a starter box, but also its own little epic narrative kind of box in its own right.
Yeah. So I don't know. Istvan box set or something be cool. Or yeah. Siege of Terror. Let's just go with it. Siege of Terror.
Awesome. And that brings us to the end of our choices for this week's top three. We do have one final segment to quickly run through, and that is the community top three, and that is coming up next. And so we come to the final section of this week's podcast, and it is the community top three picks. Now, apologies if we don't read yours out. This was an incredibly popular top three. So thank you to everybody for contributing some fantastic choices. We just wish we could read out all of them. Starting over on Facebook, Mike Loads, his third choice was Manowar. I enjoyed Dreadfleet, but this was the better system. I never played Manowar, and to be fair, I think I only ever had one game of Dreadfleet. But I liked the minis from Dreadfleet. They were really cool.
Yeah, well, when Dreadfleet was like a self-contained game, Manowar was our fleets. Like, think Battlefleet Gothic, but with actual boats, and you're halfway there.
His second choice is Warmaster, felt a lot more epic and more like a general of a huge army. And his top choice was Battlefleet Gothic, possibly my favourite Games Workshop game of all time. Andy Singleton says Mordheim, Battlefleet Gothic and Epic, not necessarily in that order. Nathaniel Nichols, he also goes Warmaster as his third choice, maybe set in the AOS universe and you could recreate the great battles in grand scale. His second choice is Epic. And his top choice is a bit of a cheap one. And I thought this was quite a good one for you, Matt, with the historical stuff that you're playing at the moment. But he puts, I was a fan of the old Warhammer historical series. And while they didn't have exclusive minis, Games Workshop produced this fantastic series of historical rules ranging from ancients all the way to the Great War. I would love to see it come back with a new rule set. I have so many memories of hammering my dad's Saxons with my band of hairy Vikings. Because you've been quite into like historical stuff recently.
I have, yeah. It is quite nice painting up, I suppose, real armies, and you can look at like imagery of what uniforms they had and what banners they had, and that quite appeals at the nerdy painting side, I guess.
Eric Pepper says Space Hulk, Manowar, Gorkamorka, and Mordheim. That's the top four there, Eric. Craig Brayton, Manowar, Space Marine / Epic 40k, and Mordheim. Sean Gleason says Manowar, Epic and Battlefleet Gothic. And Russell Ray, to finish us off on Facebook, just literally says BFG. Matt, what do we have over on Twitter?
Well, we had a lot of responses. I can't go through them all, but it seems to be that the consensus was Epic, Mordheim and Battlefleet Gothic tend to be the ones that are jumping out for everyone. And you know what? I could see all three of those games getting kind of redone from Games Workshop. But what I am going to do is jump into some of the funny ones that I've read. So Garrow put an AOS reboot of Mordheim with all the variety and scope of the three cities that have tons of room to get creative. So this is it. As much as I said earlier, Mordheim, I'd personally set it in Mordheim and have it old school. It could be easily ported to AOS as long as it was a grim dark city, but we've got that, haven't we, in Curse City? So possibility. Garrow also says Battlefleet Gothic with a Heresy era setting, an Inquisitor but in 28mm scale, so people can really learn how to do Blanchitsu models, which is, yeah, that's pretty cool. Andrew Jameson says Mordheim, Hero Quest and Space Hulk. So Space Hulk's had a couple of iterations over the year, but I think that's an oldie but a goodie, where they could, I'm sure they could put out a new version of Space Hulk with new models and everyone would buy it again, wouldn't they? Hero Quest, an interesting one. I never played Hero Quest. It was kind of like a precursor to Warhammer Quest, in that it was a kind of an adventure game like that. And again, all the Kickstarters are kind of going on the whole dungeon crawl thing. I'm surprised we haven't seen, I know we finally got a new AOS themed dungeon crawler, but I'm surprised we didn't see it earlier, to be honest, because they have been super popular, haven't they?
We have got Hero Quest is coming back, but not in any way related to Games Workshop. I think Hasbro have got the license now. Maybe they've overstepped the license, but they're bringing back Hero Quest, I think, by Kickstarter actually. But Games Workshop aren't doing the minis. It's somebody else.
Yeah, Games Workshop got no involvement in the game whatsoever.
No.
So And I'm going to butcher this name, but Icarus Potion. Oh, Icarus Potion. Okay, that's easier than it looked originally. Gorkamorka have Gaz about to take a planet and lose, only to be saved by the Gorkamorka tribes returning to win the battle. So Gorkamorka is one that very nearly hit my list because it is very close to my heart. And again, I like Necromunda. This is Necromunda with orcs. I could have gone Gorkamorka, Mordheim and Necromunda, couldn't I? But, you know, we've got a new Necromunda box coming. Yeah, it was such a good game. And, you know, Rebel Grots for the win. Mugs of Doom Mini says Mordheim, Inquisitor and Epic using existing Titanicus and Aeronautica models. And a certain Mr. Ray Dranfield says Mordheim, 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 which in itself got a whole plethora of responses and people asking him to make the scenery. And yeah, I'm sure people would be very happy if that's the case, but I'm sure Ray wouldn't be able to tell anybody until it's out. Laurent says Warhammer Fantasy Battles. Now, interestingly, we've got the Old World coming out, so I'm assuming that's going to be pretty much reimagined Warhammer and not, as some people have suggested, maybe a more Warmaster style game. So, yeah, that again, we don't know how far that is off as well, so that's exciting. Jamie from Realm of Plastic said Trolls in the Pantry. So this was a classic game that used a cassette tape and had some silly songs. Yeah, we absolutely need to see this this re-released. Tabletop Bellhop says Space Fleet, which was the precursor to Battlefleet Gothic, Advanced Hero Quest, and the Troll Games. The kids' game that came with Trollist Tunes tape. So, yeah, everybody for the old school tape-based games. You know what I'd like to say? It's not a Games Workshop game, and slightly adjacent to that point. Do you remember the video board game Atmosphere?
I do, yeah.
Driven by a VHS tape. Yep. We need this in some kind of like Warhammer form with the VHS as well. Games Workshop can like produce them just for this game or something. We've also had quite a few shout outs for Dreadfleet. So Henry Hunt says Dreadfleet got fantastic memories of it when it first came out and would love to play it again. I've actually got this boxed down the stairs. We should have a game of this, maybe even stream a game of Dreadfleet.
I'd love to play Dreadfleet. I'd love the little dwarf ironclad. It had a dirigible that could come out of it, didn't it?
It did, yeah. So I've got it painted up now. It's an old shoddy paint job. I might have to touch them up a little bit, but yeah, we absolutely need to do that. But yeah, we've got hundreds of responses here. Thank you so much if you did shout in. Like I say, across the board, generally speaking, Epic, Mordheim, and Battlefleet Gothic seems to be the favourite. So hopefully we'll get one of those soon.
Excellent stuff, Matt. I think that leads us to ask, what is next week's top three?
So next week, we want to know your top three hobby bargains, whether it be an eBay find, a deal you got in a shop, or even some battle boxes that you thought were particularly good value. We want to know.
Excellent stuff. You can get your choices in via social media at Sprues and Brews over on Twitter or facebook.com/Sprues and Brews. We'd love to hear your top threes. We usually put a post out on the Sunday before recording. Feel free to reply to that as well. And get your choices in.
Could you imagine going to that car boot sale and finding a Forge World Tau Manta in a £1.50 box?
Can you imagine?
that would be a bargain, wouldn't it?
I've got a story, but I'm saving it for my top three next week.
I've got a story as well, but I'm saving mine for the top three next week. There you go, getting them in early. I think that brings us to the end of another week's episode of the Sprues and Brews podcast. Thank you to everybody for joining us on our podcast adventure. We'll be back again next week with a brand new episode. Until then, have a great week of hobby, and we'll speak to you all again very soon. Bye.
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 Thanks for listening to the Sprues and Brews podcast. For more content, remember to check out spruesandbrews.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, send us a tweet at Sprues and Brews, or head over to facebook.com/Sprues and Brews.